I was in Africa. I read about them over there. If you'll notice, they referred to the rioters as vandals, hoodlums, thieves. They tried to make it appear that this wasn't, they tried to make it, they did this. They skillfully took the burden off the society for its failure to corrupt, to correct these negative conditions in the black community. Took the burden completely off the society and put it right on the community by using the press to make it appear that the looting and all of this was the proof that the whole act was nothing but vandals and robbers and thieves who weren't really interested in anything other than that which was negative. And I hear many old, dumb, brainwashed Negroes who parrot the same old party line that the man handed down in his paper. It was not the case that they were just knocking out store windows ignorantly. In Harlem, for instance, all of the stores are owned by white people. All the buildings are owned by white people. The black people are just there, paying rent, buying the groceries. But they don't own the stores, the clothing stores, food stores, any kind of store. Don't even own the homes that they live in. This is all owned by outsiders. And in these run-down apartment dwellings, the black man in Harlem pays more money for it than the man down in the rich Park Avenue section. It costs us higher, more money to live in the slum than it costs them to live down on Park Avenue. And black people in Harlem know this. And the white merchants charge us more money for food in Harlem. And it's the cheap food. It's the worst food. We have to pay more money for it than the man has to pay for it downtown. So black people know that they're being exploited and that their blood is being sucked and they see no way out of it. So finally, when the spark thing is sparked, the white man is not there. He's gone. The merchant is not there. The landlord is not there. The one he considers to be the enemy isn't there. So they knock at his property. This is what makes them knock down the store windows and set fire to things and things of that sort. It's not that they're thieves, but they try and project the image to the public that this is being done by thieves and thieves alone. And they ignore the fact that, no, it is not thievery alone. It's a corrupt, vicious, hypocritical system that has castrated the black man. And the only way the black man can get back at it is to strike it in the only way he knows how. They use the press. That doesn't mean that all reporters are bad. Some of them are good, I suppose. But you can take their collective approach to any problem and see that they can always agree when it gets to you and me. And they knew that this affair, which is designed to honor outstanding black Americans, is it not? You find nothing in the newspapers to give the slightest hint that this affair was going to take place. Not one hint. Why? You see, you have many sources of news. If you don't think that they're in cahoots, why? They're all interested, or none of them are interested. It's not a staggering thing. They're not going to say anything in advance that's being given by any black people who believe in functioning beyond the scope of the ground rules that are laid down by the liberal element of the power structure. When you begin to start thinking for yourself, you frighten them. And they try and block your getting to the public for fear that if the public listens to you, then the public won't listen to them anymore. And they've got certain Negroes whom they have to keep blowing up in the paper to make them look like leaders so that the people will keep on following them no matter how many knots they get on their head following him. This is how the man does it. And if you don't wake up and find out how he does it, I tell you, they'd be building gas chambers and gas ovens pretty soon. I don't mean no time you got at home in your kitchen. Another example at the international level of how skillfully they use this trickery was in the Congo. In the Congo, airplanes were dropping bombs on African villages. African villages don't have a defense against bombs, and the pilot can't tell who the bomb is being dropped upon. When a bomb hits the village, everything goes. And these pilots, filled with driving flying planes filled with bombs, dropping these bombs on African villages, were destroying women, were destroying children, were destroying babies. You never heard any outcry over here about that.
And it had started way back in June. They would drop bombs on African villages that would blow that village apart and everything in it. Man, woman, child, and baby. No outcry, no sympathy, no support, no concern, because the press didn't project it in such a way that it would be designed to get your sympathy. They know how to put something so that you'll sympathize with it, and they know how to put it so you'll be against it. I'm telling you, they are masters at it. And if you don't develop the analytical ability to read between the lines in what they're saying, I'm telling you again, they'll be building that gas ovens. And before you wake up, you'll be in one of them, just like the Jews ended up in gas ovens over there in Germany. You're in a society that's just as capable of building gas ovens for black people as Hitler's society was. This was mass murder in the Congo of women and children and babies. But there was no outcry even from the white liberals, even from your friends. Why? Because they made it appear that it was a humanitarian project. They said that the planes were being flown by American-trained anti-Castro Cuban pilots. This is propaganda, too. As soon as you hear the American-trained, you say, oh, that's all right, that's us. And the anti-Castro Cubans, oh, that's all right, too, because if they're against Castro, whoever else they're against, that's good, because Castro's a monster. But you see how step by step they grab your mind? And these pilots are hired. Their salaries are paid by the United States government. They're called mercenaries, these pilots are. And a mercenary is not someone who kills you because he's patriotic. He kills you for blood money. He's a hired killer. That's what a mercenary means. And they're able to take these hired killers, put them in American planes with American bombs and drop them on African villages, blowing to bits black men, black women, black children, black babies, and you black people sitting over here cool like it doesn't even involve you. You're a fool. They'll do it to them today and do it to you tomorrow. Because you and I and they are all the same. They call it a humanitarian project, and that they're doing it in the name of freedom. And all of this, these glorious terms are used to pave the way in your mind for what they're going to do. Then they take Shombi. You heard of Shombi. He's the worst African that was ever born. The lowest type that was ever born. He's a murderer himself. He's the murderer of Lumumba, the former prime minister of the first and only rightful prime minister of the Congo. He's an international, he's a murderer with an international stature as a murderer. Yet the United States government went and got Shombi in Spain and put him as the head of the Congolese government. Imagine this, this is criminal. Here's a man who's a murderer. So the United States takes him, puts him over the Congo, and supports his government with your tax dollars. Now, in other words, they hire him to occupy the position as head of state over the Congo. A killer. He is a hired killer himself. His salary paid by the United States government. And he turns, his first move is to bring in South Africans who hate everything in sight. He hires those South Africans to come and kill his own Congolese people. And the United States, again, pays their salary. You know, it's something to think about. How do you think you would feel right now if some Congolese brothers walked up to you? They look just like you. Don't think you don't look Congolese. You look as much Congolese as a Congolese does. They got all kinds of Congolese over there. How would you feel if one of them walked up to you and asked you about what your government is doing in the Congo? I was asked that when I was over there. But they didn't have to come to me like that, because they know where I stand automatically anyway. And for which I'm thankful to the press for letting everybody know where I stand. But you have no explanation. Your tongue stays in your mouth. And you have to then go to the extreme to convince them that you don't go along with what the United States government is doing in the Congo. But again, your image making comes into importance here. And they justify the usage of Shombi as the present head of state by saying he's the only African who can unite or bring unity to the Congo. Has he brought unity to the Congo? But see, this is their game. And their real reason for wanting Chombe there was so that Chombe could invite them to come in. No other African head of state would have dared to invite outside powers. So they put Chombe there. And as soon as Chombe got there, then he invited them to bring paratroopers from Belgium in the United States transport planes to try and recapture the Congo. This is all a cold-blooded act on the part of your Western powers, namely the Western powers here in the United States, the interest in the United States, in England, in France, and in Belgium, and so forth. They want the wealth of the Congo, plus its strategic geographic position. The step-by-step process that was used by the press, first they fanned the flame in such a manner to create hysteria in the mind of the public, and then they shift gears and fan the flame in a manner designed to get the sympathy of the public. And once they go from hysteria to sympathy, their next step is to get the public to support them in whatever act they're getting ready to go down with. You're dealing with a cold, calculating international machine that's so criminal in its objectives and motives that it has the seeds of its own destruction right within it. They use the press to emphasize that white hostages are being held by cannibals. Imagine that. Or white priests, white missionaries, white nuns. They don't say nuns. White nuns. You know what the paper said right here in Detroit. White missionary. Not just a missionary. A white nun. As if there's a difference between a white nun and a black nun. Or a white priest and a black priest. Or if the life that's in a white skin is more valuable than a life within a black skin. This is what they're implying. And the press, go get the press when this thing was going on, and you see what I'm talking about. They're vicious in their whiteness. But still, I wouldn't judge them just because they're white, because they call me a racist. Judging by their deeds, by their conscious behavior. And you know how they've been consciously behaving in the Congo, and how they consciously behave in Vietnam, and how they consciously behave right now in Alabama and Mississippi. So you and I got to get conscious and start behaving in a way that we can offset this thing before it's too late. And this is what they don't want to hear. One more thing concerning Chombe. If you notice, and I must go all over there on the African continent in order to give you a better understanding of what's going on right here. The next thing that is good to know about Chombe, no Congolese troops have ever won any victories whatsoever for the present Congolese government. Congolese soldiers won't even fight unless they're forced to. But the fighters in the Congo were the freedom fighters, these brothers from the Oriental Eastern province. And they fought with stones and sticks and rocks, spears and arrows. And the only time they had a gun was when they got some soldier who had it, and they kill him and take his gun. But they were winning. They took over two-thirds of the Congo, showing you they were fighting from their heart. Whereas these other people, their heart wasn't in it. And because of the fighting spirit of these people, it will be impossible for Chombe to remain as head of state over the Congo without additional troops, white troops, constantly being brought in from South Africa or elsewhere. But sooner or later, these troops are going to give out, and then America is going to have to increase her troops like she did in South Vietnam, you know. She's not at war over there, you know. They're only over there advising. They got about 20,000 advisors, you know, on the front line. But it's not a war. It's just they're in an advisory capacity while they insult the intelligence of their own public. And they're going to have to end up doing the same thing in the Congo. They'll be trapped. They'll have to eventually send American troops to occupy the Congo because the African freedom fighters are going to fight. They're not going to give up one inch without fighting back. And this is something that you should know, that they realize now on the African continent what's at stake and how much all of these Western powers have in common and what they're doing in cahoots with each other behind the closed door. So on the African continent, they are training Africans to be soldiers so that they can invade each one of these countries and take it over and give it to their rightful people. One of the reasons, one of the last things I must say concerning the Congo, not only do they not intend for the Congo to fall into African hands because of its mineral wealth, and it has the greatest deposits of some of the richest elements or minerals of any other area on this earth, They don't intend to give it up because of its wealth. Another reason they don't intend to give it up, if you look at the map, you'll see that it is so strategically located geographically, wherein if a real, genuine African government were to come in power over the Congo, then it would be possible for African troops from all countries to invade Angola, which is a Portuguese possession, and if Angola fell, and it would fall, then it would only be a matter of time before Southwest Africa, Southern Rhodesia, and Botswana also would fall, and it would put African troops right on the border of South Africa. And that's where they really want to get at that man down there in South Africa. And the United States interests are involved in blocking this. Yes, some of these liberals who grin in your face like this, face like they're your best friend, they got money tied up in the Congo. Some of the most powerful political figures in this country, some of them governors over states, got interest in the Congo and got interest in South Africa and got interest all over the African continent and go there. And as the Africans awaken and realize this, it makes them filled with the incentive to never rest until that exploiter is driven out. So now, what effect does this have on us? Why should the black man in America concern himself, since we've been away from the African continent for 400 years, 300 or 400 years? Why should we concern ourselves? What impact does what happened to them have upon us? Number one, first you have to realize that up until 1959, Africa was dominated by the colonial powers, and by the colonial powers of Europe having complete control over Africa, they projected the image of Africa negatively. They projected Africa always in a negative light. Jungles, savages, cannibals, nothing civilized. And naturally, it was so negative until it was negative to you and me. And you and I began to hate it. We didn't want anybody to tell us anything about Africa, and much less call us an African. And in hating Africa and hating the African, we ended up even hating ourselves without even realizing it. Because you can't hate the roots of a tree and not hate the tree. You can't hate your origin and not end up hating yourself. You can't hate Africa and not hate yourself. And you show me one of these people over here who have been thoroughly brainwashed, who has a negative attitude toward Africa, and I'll show you one that has a negative attitude toward himself. You can't have a positive attitude toward yourself and a negative attitude toward Africa at the same time. To the same degree that your attitude, that your understanding of, an attitude toward Africa becomes positive, you'll find that your understanding of and your attitude toward yourself will also become positive. And this is what the white man knows. So they very skillfully made you and me hate our African identity, our African characteristics. And you know yourself that we have been a people who hated our African characteristics. We hated our hair. We hated the shape of our nose. We wanted one of those long dog-like noses, you know. Yeah. We hated the color of our skin. Hated the blood of Africa that was in our veins. And in hating our features and our skin and our blood, why, we had to end up hating ourselves. And we hated ourselves. Our color became to us a chain. We felt that it was holding us back. Our color became to us like a prison, which we felt was keeping us confined, not letting us go this way or that way. And we felt that all of these restrictions were based solely upon our color, and the psychological reaction to that would have to be that as long as we felt imprisoned or chained or trapped by black skin, black features, and black blood, that skin and those features and that blood that was holding us back automatically had to become hateful to us. And it became hateful to us. It made us feel inferior. It made us feel inadequate. It made us feel helpless. And when we fell victim to this feeling of inadequacy or inferiority or helplessness, we turned to somebody else to show us the way. We didn't have confidence in another black man to show us the way, or black people to show us the way. In those days, we didn't. We didn't think a black man could do anything but play some horn, you know, some sound, and make you happy with some songs, and in that way. In serious things, where our food, clothing, and shelter was concerned, and our education was concerned, we turned to the man. We never thought in terms of bringing these things into existence for ourselves. We never thought in terms of doing things for ourselves because we felt helpless. And what made us feel helpless was our hatred for ourselves. And our hatred for ourselves stemmed from our hatred of things African. Along about 1955, they had the Bandung Conference in Indonesia. And at that time, the Africans, the Asians, the Arabs, all of the non-white people got together and agreed to de-emphasize their differences and emphasize what they had in common and form a working unity. And it was the working unity, the spirit of Bandung, created a working unity that made it possible for the Asians who were oppressed, the Africans who were oppressed, and others who were oppressed, to work together toward getting independence for these other people. And it was the spirit of Bandung that brought into existence this working unity that made it possible for nations that didn't have a chance to become independent, they did come into their independence. And most of this began along in 1959. And at 59, the spirit of African nationalism was a flame, was fanned to a high flame. And we then began to witness the complete collapse of colonialism. France began to get out of French West Africa. Belgium began to make moves to get out of the Congo. Britain began to make moves to get out of Kenya, Tanganyika, Uganda, Nigeria, and some of these other places. And although it looked like they were getting out, they pulled a trick that was colossal. In that when you're playing basketball and they get you trapped, you don't throw the ball away. You throw it to one of your teammates who's in the cliff. And this is what the European powers did. They were trapped on the African continent. They couldn't stay there. They were looked upon as colonial imperialists. So they had to pass the ball to someone whose image was different. And they passed the ball to Uncle Sam. And he picked it up and has been running it for a touchdown ever since. He was in the clear. He was not looked upon as one who had colonized the African continent. But at that time, the Africans couldn't see that though the United States hadn't colonized the African continent, he had colonized 22 million blacks here on this continent. Because we were just as thoroughly colonized as anybody else. When the ball was passed to the United States, it was passed at a time when John Kennedy came into power. He picked it up and helped to run it. Was one of the shrewdest backfield runners that history has ever recorded. He surrounded himself with intellectuals, highly educated, learned, and well-informed people. And their analysis told him that the government of America was confronted with a new problem. And this new problem stemmed from the fact that Africans were now awakened, they were enlightened, and they were fearless. They would fight. So this meant that the Western powers couldn't stay there by force, and since their own economies, the European economy and the American economy, was based upon their influence, continued influence over the African continent, they had to find some means of staying there. So they used the friendly approach. They switched from the old open colonial imperialistic approach to the benevolent approach. They come up with some benevolent colonialism, philanthropic colonialism, humanitarianism, or dollarism. Immediately, everything was Peace Corps, Crossroads. We've got to help our African brothers. Pick up on that. Can't help us in Mississippi. Can't help us in Alabama or Detroit, out here in Dearborn, where some real Ku Klux Klan live. We're going to send all the way to Africa to help. I know Dearborn, you know. I'm from Detroit. I used to live out here in Easton. And you had to go through Dearborn to get to Easton. Just like riding through Mississippi when you got to Dearborn. Is it still that way? Well, you should straighten it up. So, realizing that it was necessary to come up with these new approaches, Kennedy did it. He won. He created an image of himself that was skillfully designed to make the people on the African continent think that he was Jesus, the great white father, come to make things right. And I'm telling you, some of these Negroes cried harder when he died than they cried for Jesus when he was crucified. From 1960 to from 1954 to 1964 was the era in which we witnessed the emerging of Africa. And the impact that this had upon the civil rights struggle in America has never been told, fully told. For one reason, for one thing, one of the primary ingredients in the complete civil rights struggle was the Black Muslim movement. The Black Muslim movement, though it took no part in things political, civic, didn't take too much part in anything other than stopping people from doing this, drinking, smoking, and so on. Moral reform it had, but beyond that it did nothing. But it talked such a strong talk until it put the other Negro organizations on the spot. Before the Black Muslim movement came along, the NAACP was looked upon as radical. They were getting ready to investigate. And then along came the Muslim movement, and it frightened the white man so much, he began to say, thank God for old Uncle Roy and Uncle Whitney and Uncle A. Phillip and Uncle... got a whole lot of uncles in there. I can't remember their names. They're all older than I, so I call them uncle. Plus, if you use the word Uncle Tom nowadays, I heard they sue you for libel, you know. So I don't call any of them Uncle Tom anymore. I call him Uncle Roy. One of the things that made the Black Muslim movement grow was its emphasis upon things African. This was the secret to the growth of the Black Muslim movement. African blood, African origin, African culture, African ties. And you'd be surprised. We discovered that deep within the subconscious of the black man in this country, he's still more African than he is American. He thinks that he's more American than African because the man is jiving him and the man is brainwashing him every day, telling him, you're an American, you're an American. Man, how could you think you're an American and you haven't ever had any kind of American treat over here? You have never, never. 10 men can be sitting at a table, eating, you know, dining. And I can come and sit down where they're dining. They're dining. I got a plate in front of me, but nothing is on it. Because all of us are sitting at the same table, are all of us diners? I'm not a diner until you let me dine. Then I become a diner. Just being at the table with others who are dining doesn't make me a diner. And this is what you got to get in your head here in this country. Just because you're in this country doesn't make you an American. And no, you got to go farther than that before you can become an American. You got to enjoy the fruits of Americanism. And you haven't enjoyed those fruits. You've enjoyed the thorns. You've enjoyed the thistles, but you have not enjoyed the fruits. No, sir. You have fought harder for the fruits than the white man had. You have worked harder for the fruits than the white man had, but you've enjoyed less. You, when the man put the uniform on you and sent you abroad, you fought harder than they did. Yeah, I know you. When you're fighting for them, you can fight. The Black Muslim movement did make that contribution. They made the whole civil rights movement become more militant and more acceptable to the white power structure. He would rather have them than us. In fact, I think we forced many of the civil rights leaders to be even more militant than they intended. I know some of them who get out there boom, 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 and don't mean it. Because they round back in their corner as soon as the action come. John F. Kennedy also saw that it was necessary for a new approach among the American Negroes. And during his entire term in office, he specialized in how to psycho the American Negro. Now, a lot of y'all don't like my saying this, but I wouldn't ever take a stand on that if I didn't know what I was talking about. And I don't, by living in this kind of society, pretty much around them, and you know what I mean when I say them, I learned to study them. And you can think that they mean you some good oftentimes, and if you look at it a little closer, you'll see that they don't mean you any good. That doesn't mean there aren't some of them who mean good. But it does mean that most of them don't mean good. Kennedy's new approach was pretending to go along with us in our struggle for civil rights and different other forms of rights. But I remember the expose that Look magazine did on Meredith's situation in Mississippi. And Look magazine did an expose showing that Robert Kennedy and Governor Barnett had made a deal wherein the Attorney General was going to come down and try and force Meredith in school, and and Barnett was going to stand at the door, you know, and say, no, you can't come in. And he was going to get in anyway. But it was all arranged in advance. And then Barnett was supposed to keep the support of the white racists because that's who he's holding up. And Kennedy would keep the support of the Negroes because that's who he'd be holding up. And it was a cut and drag deal. And it's not a secret. It was written. They write about it. Funny now, if that's a deal and that's a deal, how many other deals do you think go down? What you think is on the level is crookeder, brothers and sisters, than a pretzel, which is most crooked. So in my conclusion, I would like to point out that the approach that was used by the administration right on up until today, even the present generation, was designed skillfully to make it appear that they were trying to solve the problem when they actually weren't. They would deal with the condition, but never the cause. They only give us tokenism. Tokenism benefits only a few. It never benefits the masses. And the masses are the ones who have the problem, not the few. That one who benefits from tokenism, he doesn't want to be around us anyway. That's why he picks up on the token. You ever notice how some Negroes will brag, I'm the only one out there. I'm the only one on my job. Don't you hear him say that? Yeah, that you ought to punch him in his... No, he's your brother. You shouldn't punch your brother. But you should really get... You can punch him with some words. You should... Whenever you see a Negro bragging about, he's the only one in this neighborhood. He's bragging. He's telling you, in essence, I'm surrounded by white folks, you know? I love them and they love me. Oh, yes, and on his job. I'm the only one on my job. I've been listening to that stuff all my life. And the generation that's coming up, they're not going to be saying that. The generation that's coming up, everybody's going to look like an Uncle Tom to them. And you and I have to learn that in time so that we don't pose that image when our people, when our young generation come up and begin to look at us. The masses of our people still have bad housing, bad schooling, and inferior jobs that don't compensate with sufficient salary for them to carry on their life in this world. So that the problem for the masses has gone absolutely unsolved. And the only one for whom it has been solved are people like Whitney Young, who's supposed to be placed in the cabinet, so the rumors say. He'll be one of the first black cabinet men, and that answers where he's at. And others who have been given jobs, Carl Rowan, who was put over the USIS, who is very skillfully trying to make Africans think that the problem of the black man in this country is all solved. And this is the worst thing the white man can do to himself, is to take one of these kind of Negroes and ask him, how do your people feel, boy? And he's going to tell that man that we are satisfied. And that's what they do, brothers and sisters. So they get behind the door and tell the white man we're satisfied. Just keep me up here in front of them, boss, and I'll keep them behind you. That's what they talk when they enter behind closed doors. Because, see, the white man doesn't go along with anybody who's not for him. He doesn't care whether you're for right or wrong. He wants to know, are you for him? And if you're for him, he doesn't care what else you're for, as long as you're for him. Then he puts you up over the Negro community. You become the spokesman. And in your struggle, it's like standing on a revolving anywhere. You run faster and faster, and the wheel just goes faster and faster. You never leave the spot that you're standing in. So it is very important for you and me to see that the only way that our problem is going to be solved, it has to be with a solution that will benefit the masses, not the upper class, so-called upper class. Actually, there's no such thing as an upper class Negro, because he gets the same hell as the other class Negro. All of them get the same hell, which is one of the things that's good about this racist system. It makes us all one. Quickly, if you'll notice, in 1963, everyone was talking about the centennial of progress. I think that's what they called it. 100 years since the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation, and they were going to celebrate how much white and black people have learned to love each other in America. You probably remember how they were talking in January of 1963. Well, if you had stood up in January at the same time that they were talking all this talk about a good year ahead, good things ahead, and told them that by May, Birmingham would have exploded and Bull Connor would be known as an international thug for the brutality that he heaped upon black people. If you would tell the people in January of 63 that John F. Kennedy would be killed for his role in everything, If you had told them in January that Medgar Evers would be murdered and nobody able to bring his killer to justice, or if you were to have told them in January of 1963 that a church would be bombed in Birmingham with four little black girls blown to bits while they were praying and serving Jesus, why, they would say you're crazy. In 1964, they started out the same way. That was the year of promise. If you were to have told them while they were talking about this great year of promise ahead, you know, civil rights and all of that, what was coming, that before long, three civil rights workers would be brutally murdered and the government unable to do anything about it. A Negro educator in Georgia brutally murdered in broad daylight, and the men who did it be known and the government not able to do anything about it. If you had said this in January of 64, they'd say you were not. Now they're starting out in 1965 the same way, talking about the great society, you know, anti-poverty. If you tell them right now what is in store for 1965, they'll think you crazy for sure. But 1965 will be the longest and hottest and bloodiest year of them all. And it has to be. Not because you want it to be, or I want it to be, or we want it to be, but because the conditions that created these explosions in 1963 are still here. The conditions that created explosions in 64 are still here. You can't say that you're not going to have an explosion and you leave the condition. The ingredients are still here. And as long as those ingredients, explosive ingredients, remain, then you're going to have the potential for explosion on your hands. And brothers and sisters, let me say, I spend my time out there in the streets with people, all kind of people, listening to what they have to say. And they're dissatisfied. They're disillusioned. They're fed up. They're getting to the point of frustration where they are beginning to feel, what do they have to lose? And when you get to that point, you're the type of person who can create a very dangerously explosive atmosphere. This is what's happening in our neighborhoods to our people. I read in a poll taken by Newsweek magazine this week saying that Negroes are satisfied. Oh yes, poll, you know, in Newsweek, supposed to be a top magazine with a top poster, talking about how satisfied Negroes are. Maybe I haven't met the Negroes he met. Because I know he hasn't met the ones that I've met. But this is dangerous. This is where the white man does himself the most harm. He invents statistics to create an image, thinking that that image is going to hold things in check. You know why they always say Negroes are lazy? Because they want Negroes to be lazy. They always say Negroes can't unite because they don't want Negroes to unite. And once they put this thing in the mind, they feel that the Negro gets that into him, and he tries to fulfill that image. If you say you can't unite him, and then you come to him to unite him, he won't unite because it's been said that he's not supposed to unite. It's a cycle that they work, and it's the same way with these statistics. When they think that an explosive error is coming up, then they grab their press again and begin to shower the Negro public to make it appear that all Negroes are satisfied. And because if you know that you're dissatisfied all by yourself and 10 others aren't, you play it cool. But you know if all 10 of you are satisfied, you get with it. Well, this is what the man knows. The man knows that if these Negroes find out how dissatisfied they really are, and all of them, even Uncle Tom is dissatisfied, he's just playing his part for now. This is what makes them frightened. It frightens them in France, it frightens them in England, and it frightens them in the United States. And it is for this reason that it is so important for you and me to start organizing among ourselves intelligently and try to find out what are we going to do if this happens, that happens, or the next thing happens. Don't think that you're just going to run to the man and say, look, boss, this is me. Why, when the deal goes down, you look just like me in his eyesight. I'll make it tough for you. Yes, when the deal goes down, he doesn't look at you in any better light than he looks at me. I was on a television program in New York last week. One of the liberals did a takeoff on James Farmer. Now, here's James Farmer teaching Negroes to be nonviolent and loving and all of that. Why, they should be patting him on the back. And instead of them patting him on the back, they want to knock at him and put me in a position of having to defend him. Which I did. I was glad to, because I wanted to crack this man's neck anyway. And mentally. Intellectually. So I point these things out, brothers and sisters, so that you and I will know the importance in 1965 of being in complete unity with each other, harmony with each other, and not letting the man maneuver us into fighting one another. There is a situation where I have been maneuvered right now between me and the black Muslim movement, something that I really deeply regret, because I don't think anything is more destructive than two groups of black people fighting each other. But something that can't be avoided, because it goes deep down beneath the surface, and these things will come up in the very near future. And I might say this before I sit down. If you recall, when I left the black Muslim movement, I stated clearly that it wasn't my intention to even continue to be aware that they existed, but that I was going to spend my time working in the non-Muslim community. But they were fearful that if they didn't do something, that perhaps many of those who were in the mosque would leave it and follow a different direction. So they had to start doing a takeoff on me, plus they had to try and silence me because of what they know that I know. And I should think that they should know me well enough to know that they certainly can't frighten me. But when it does come to the light, excuse me for keep coughing like that, but I got some of that smoke last night. But there are some things involving the black Muslim movement which, when they come to light, you will be shocked. The thing that you have to understand, where those of us in the black Muslim movement were concerned, all of us believed 100% in the divinity of Elijah Muhammad. We believed in him. We actually believed that God had taught him, right here in Detroit, by the way, that God had taught him and all of that. And I always thought that he believed in himself. And I was shocked when I found out that he himself didn't believe it. And when that shock reached me, then I began to look everywhere else and try to get a better understanding of the things that confront all of us so that we can get together in some kind of way to offset it. I want to thank you for coming out this afternoon, this evening. I think it's wonderful that as many of you came out, considering the blackout on the meeting that took place. Also, and the brothers who are here are very progressive young men, and I would advise all of you to get with them in every way that you can to try and create some kind of united effort toward common goals, common objectives, and don't let the power structure maneuver you into a time-wasting battle with others when you could be involved in something that's constructive and getting a real job done. One thing I should have pointed out to you, that once we formed our new organization, once we became identified with the Orthodox Muslim world, we also formed a group known as the Organization of Afro-American Unity, which is designed to fight all the negative political, economic, and social conditions that exist in our neighborhood. It's a non-religious organization to which anyone can belong who's interested in direct action. And one of our first programs is to take our problem out of the civil rights context and place it at the international level of human rights so that the entire world can have a voice in our struggle. If we keep it at civil rights, then the only place we can turn for allies is within the domestic confines of America. But when you make it a human rights struggle, it becomes international. And then you can open the door for all types of advice and support from our brothers in Africa, Latin America, Asia, and elsewhere. So it's very, very important. That's our international aim. That's our external aim. Our internal aim is to become immediately involved in a mass voters registration drive, but we don't believe in voter registration without voter education. We believe that our people should be educated into the science of politics so that they will know what a vote is for, what a vote is supposed to produce, and also how to utilize this united voting power so that you can control the politics of your own community and the politicians that represent that community. We're for that. And in that line, we will work with all other, even the civil rights groups, who are dedicated to increase the number of black registered voters in the South. The only area in which we differ with them is this. We don't believe that young students should be sent into Mississippi, Alabama, and these other places without some kind of protection. So we will join in with them in their voter registration. And help to train brothers in the arts, in the arts that are necessary in this day and age to enable one to continue his existence upon this earth. I say that again, that I'm not a racist. I don't believe in any form of segregation or anything like that. I'm for the brotherhood of everybody, but I don't believe in enforcing brotherhood upon people who don't want it. As long as we practice brotherhood among ourselves, And then others who want to practice brotherhood with us, we practice it with them also. We're for that. But I don't think that we should run around trying to love somebody who doesn't love us. Thank you.